Morning. We're continuing with our series through the Sermon on the Mount. As we spend this summer working through this longest teaching of Jesus that we have, as Jesus lays out part of what it means to be a follower of God and of Christ, as we let Christ rule our lives, what does that look like? And so this actually is kind of a transition point in the sermon in many ways, as we'll see coming up. But we continue our conversation today talking about deep generosity. One of the first phrases that I learned in Spanish was mirame. Now, I have a weird accent from learning in Argentina, so those who speak Spanish, just bear with me. Mirame. I heard it everywhere that I went, which is why it was one of the phrases that I was like, okay, now I have to know what this means. And I heard it everywhere, on the playground, on the subway, in the streets, on the soccer pitch. Mirame, mirame, mirame. And typically, it was children, because mirame is the universal cry of children around the world. Look at me. Watch me. Look at what I can do. Because children were always looking for that recognition. They wanted to see if we were truly watching what they were up to. Look at what I just learned. Look at how fast I can run. Look at what I made out of this random assortment of sticks and toys and kitchen supplies and dirt from the yard. Look at what I can do. Mirame. But that phrase isn't just for children. Almost all of us are looking for recognition in the things that we can accomplish. Sometimes we want to show off to attract the attention of friends or of a potential date. Sometimes we just want people to know how good we are. There are competitions, talent competitions like The Voice, in which people try to demonstrate just how well they can sing in front of an audience because they're looking for that recognition of their talent. Or shows like America's Got Talent, which allow people to show off their skills and talents, from Irish folk dancing to sword swallowing to ventriloquism, and on and on and on it goes. And I'm going to tell you, the day that they find a person who is swallowing a sword while throwing their voice and dancing a jig, that person needs to win it all. But none of us are immune to mirame. How many of us, if we do some sort of work around the house, would really love our spouse to acknowledge it? Or we'd like to hear some positive comments from our supervisors at work. Or we'd love to be told that we did a good job in our race, or with a specific project, or in volunteering with the nonprofit down the road. Whether it's in our marriage or in our job or our time with our friends, we often go looking for those words of recognition. So much so that sometimes we feel the need to trumpet our achievements as quietly as we can so we don't call too much attention to it, but that so people will know just kind of how good we are. Watch me. Acknowledge me. Look at what I can do. Pay attention to my accomplishments. Now, I want us to hear this. There's nothing wrong with needing affirmation from time to time. We all need to be told that we are doing a good job at times in our lives. In fact, we are called as Christians to encourage and to edify one another, and that is a deeply spiritual practice of love and grace that we give for the sake of our brothers and sisters in Christ. There's nothing wrong with needing affirmation from time to time, but we need to look at our motivations. The underlying question that we need to ask ourselves is this: why am I doing what I'm doing? Is it to help other people, to use my gifts, or to do a good job simply for the sake of doing a good job? Or do I do it so that someone might notice and think well about me? What's my motivation behind what I am doing? And none of us are immune to that questionable motivation. I mean, let's be honest, sometimes we do a lot of things for the wrong motivation. Sometimes in our jobs, we just have to keep work happy, or we want to turn a questionable profit. Sometimes we do what we have to do with the wrong motivations. Sometimes that happens in our marriages. We do the things that our spouse asks us to do simply so that they'll stop griping or get off of our back. I'm not talking about my marriage. My wife is wonderful, okay? Maybe she would say that about me, I don't know. But sometimes we have questionable motivations in the things that we do. I had a friend while I was in graduate school who spent 4 years getting a Master's of Divinity degree, and then went on and did 5 more years of a PhD in biblical studies, and he had absolutely no desire to do any of those things. None. He did it because that's what his parents wanted him to do. 9 years of study and a long dissertation because of questionable motivations. Sometimes we do the things we do religiously to make other people happy, or maybe thinking if we do them right, then maybe God will think better of us. And that is the section that Jesus turns to next in the Sermon on the Mount. The sermon makes this abrupt change here in Matthew chapter 6. Before this, Jesus had been engaging them in a reinterpretation of the Jewish law. And that started with, you have heard that it was said, and then he would lay out some sort of interpretation that they had done. But then he comes back with, but then I tell you, and he reinterprets it to get closer to the heart of God. But now Jesus turns away from that discussion of doctrine and interpretation to a discussion about personal piety, the way that their religion plays out in the daily practices of their lives. And at its core, Jewish faith was comprised of these basic practices that everybody tried to do. Practices like learning to trust in the Lord their God with all of their heart, or allowing God to permeate every aspect of their day and their lives through things like reflection and meditation on His Word. Jews would stop at least 3 times a day and pray different kinds of prayers. Prayers like the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and your soul and your strength. They would pray those kinds of prayers, and they would also stop and pray their own prayers. Prayers about things going on in their lives, connecting God to the events that were happening. Jews sought to take care of the needy, giving generously to those around them. And they would stop and fast, both as a community on the high religious holidays and individually in their lives to connect with God. Now, there were a lot of other practices associated with Jewish faith, things like offering sacrifices at the temple, or traveling on those holy days, or circumcising your male children, and lots of other practices. But those practices didn't concern the daily actions of their life. You couldn't travel to Jerusalem every day. You didn't offer a sacrifice every day. Instead, it was a lot about these personal, pious practices that allowed them to connect with God, to give their lives meaning. And so Jesus, as he's standing on this hilltop, asks us to be careful in how and why we do them. Here's how Jesus segues into that next topic. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. This becomes the focal point of Jesus' message moving forward as he begins to talk about their personal piety. Jesus gives them 3 examples from their own religious life in which they must examine their motivations. The first is in giving to the needy or giving alms. The second is in the ways in which they pray. And the third is all about their fasting. And according to Jesus, these are the actions they are participating in their own lives. It's not if, but it's when you give, when you pray, when you fast, because these are an integral part of their spiritual lives. But why are we doing them? Why do we give and pray and fast? Is it to do what God has asked and to give glory to Him? Or is it so that other people are going to take notice of those things in our lives? Giving alms is a very important part of Jewish religious life. It was considered the responsibility of those who were wealthier or better off to take care of those who weren't. And sometimes that was a literal giving of money, just to beggars in the streets who needed it, or showing up to the temple or synagogues and giving so that they could in turn use that to bless their community and take care of those in need. But giving alms was often about more than just handing out money. Instead, this giving was supposed to permeate every aspect of their lives. During the harvest, landowners were not just supposed to harvest, were supposed to harvest their fields just once. And anything that might have been overlooked or dropped by their workers or a sheaf left behind was simply to be left behind. And then those who were poor, the day laborers, the widows, the orphans, and others, then could come and search and gather from the fields, taking what was left over and taking it home to take care of themselves and their own families. And God asked these landowners to also leave the edges and the corners of their fields unharvested so that they could take care of the needy among them if people would come out and take it. And this was to take care of the poor, but it was also to teach the landowners to trust in God to provide for their needs, to put following God ahead of their own profit. And every time this comes up in Scripture, they are given the motivation for why they should do this, this act of giving generously. Why? Because I am the Lord your God. He goes on to say that this should affect the way that we live and work. Those who had the means to hire day laborers were told to pay them as soon as their work was over that day so that they could go home and take care of their families and not be in debt. The people of Israel were called to offer hospitality to those that they knew and those they had no clue about. Whoever showed up was to be taken care of, whether neighbors or sojourners in the land, and strangers were to be treated with respect and care like members of their own families. The book of Tobit is a book not found in our Bibles, although it is included in the Catholic Bible, but it's one of these books written in between the Old Testament and the New Testament that kind of talks about life and times and traditions that are taking place in that time. Tobit is a man who is living in Nineveh when most of the Jews, or many of the Jews, have returned home. And he begins to give advice and the things he has learned about what it means to live for God and the daily practices of your life as you're living among people who might not know God. In many ways, it reads like Proverbs and a lot of the advice. But in Tobit chapter 4, the writer makes this statement. He says this, "If you are stingy in giving to the poor, God will be stingy in giving to you. Give according to what you have. The more you have, the more you should give. Even if you only have a little, be sure to give something. This is as good as money saved." In essence, trusting in God is like saving your money. Taking care of the poor is the kind of offering that pleases God in heaven. And this was the ethic that Judaism sought to promote, to take care of others, especially when they have nothing to give you in return. All so that God would be glorified and pleased by our actions. But, Jesus says, that's often not what happens. Oftentimes, instead of doing these things quietly, people would call attention to themselves as they were giving. And so here is how Jesus continues his message in the Sermon on the Mount. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the streets and in the synagogues, so that they may be praised by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. And scholars are torn how to kind of understand this statement that Jesus makes here. Some think that these trumpets he's referring to are the trumpets that would have sounded in the temple on the high holy days, these feast days in which people would come to celebrate God, and that's often when they would come and give their huge contributions to the temple. Others think that there was this tradition among religious leaders all kind of throughout the Jewish world in which the leaders would have a trumpet sounded anytime someone would come and make a generous donation to the synagogue. It was so that the people maybe could rejoice in what God was about to do with that money and then also rejoice for that person's generosity. Other scholars think this trumpet sound is more of a metaphor, that he's just talking about the boisterous giving and the sounds that accompany it as people are looking for that recognition. But regardless of how we want to understand it, it seems to be a very common practice. You can almost see the people on the hillside nodding as they hear these things. And Jesus says it's happening in the synagogues and even in the streets themselves. It's their way of announcing, "Come and see what I am doing. Take a look. Come and rejoice at how generous I am." And Jesus calls this all hypocrisy. Literally a wearing of a mask. These are people who aren't concerned at all about the poor. These aren't people who are giving to take care of the temple. This isn't about trusting in God and giving Him the glory. It's not about pleasing God. This is all about recognition and fame for the giver. Mirame, look at me. And instead, Jesus calls them to a different ethic, an ethic of secrecy. But when you give to the needy, he tells them, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that the giving may be done in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. The ethic Jesus is saying is this: don't call attention to yourself. Don't be flashy or forward. Don't toot your own horn. Give as generously as you can without expecting any sort of recognition or calling for any sort of attention. Give because it pleases God and it benefits others. And give trusting that God will take care of you. And that, according to Jesus, is deep generosity. A few weeks ago, Megan and I went to a seminar on getting ready for retirement. That's a very long way away, but it sounded like something we probably needed to go and at least hear about. And it turned out to be more of a seminar on estate planning and avoiding estate taxes when you die, which I really do hope is a long time away for us. But the speaker who was there spoke about leaving a legacy with your money. Leaving money for your kids and your grandkids, and leaving money that you can give away. Things like creating a scholarship at a university in your honor, or leaving a large financial contribution to your favorite charity, or creating a charitable trust in your family name to do some good with the money for years to come. It was all about giving in such a way that people could be blessed by the amount of money you were able to leave behind. But I remember sitting there thinking for a second, how often do I want to give with no strings attached, without wanting something in return? Because anytime I walk through a university's campus, I notice the names that are placed on the monuments. Whose names are on the buildings, carved into the pavers, written on plaques put up around the quad? Whose name is it attached to that building left behind? Typically, those aren't people who gave $50 to the General Scholarship Fund. No, those are typically people who gave millions and millions of dollars with the stipulation that their name would be attached to something, or that they get a place on the board of directors, or that they are given some sort of award for their achievement. Only very rarely will you see anybody give $20 million and mark it anonymous. And please hear me, there is great wonder and beauty in being able to give. Please put your money to work for the good of others. That is a wonderful blessing and a way to leave a legacy. But how would I be willing to do that? Myself, would I be willing to give and give generously with absolutely no recognition attached? Without anybody but God knowing what I had done. And this type of deep generosity doesn't have to be anything big to get God's attention. The Gospel of Luke tells a story about a time in which Jesus is standing in the temple watching as people are giving their gifts at Passover. And Luke tells us this: Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box. And from the discussion that takes place right before this, it seems that they're doing so with such great fanfare and recognition. People are seeking greetings or places of honor from the way in which they are putting their money into the collection at the temple. But then Luke gives us a second example. And he, Jesus, saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. And he said, truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For they have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. Here is a woman, Jesus says, that has learned a radical trust in God. And that allows her to practice a deep generosity done in secret. And nobody there at all Nobody would have noticed or cared had Jesus not called attention to it. Here is a woman practicing deep generosity. One of the things I love and admire about our church is our spirit of generosity. We have people here who are willing to give and give big. And I'm not just talking about large numbers, but with no recognition for their efforts. Most of us in the room have no idea who gives the largest donations here, because nobody talks about it. And even more amazingly to me is that those who give generously and out of their abundance want absolutely nothing in return. They're not seeking any sort of recognition or strings attached or demands placed or no quid pro quo, no recognition of you have to do what I want. They simply give because they've been blessed by God and they want to bless others in return, and they trust our congregation's leadership to use that money well. And from what I've seen here, that's true for all of our members, whether they give $5 or $50 or $5,000 at a time. Each of our donations is loved and respected by the church as it receives it and put to good use for God's glory and His kingdom. And it is through those donations done in secret that we're able to engage in ministries here within our church, blessing those in our congregation, as well as various outreach efforts in our city and even around the world. And I love this congregation because you're a church that practices deep generosity. And I give thanks to God for that. And I also wonder if by calling attention to that from the pulpit, I've broken the very secrecy vow that Jesus has called us to do. And I don't know, and I apologize if so, because that's really tough to do. But I want us to stop and think for a moment. How is it that you can practice deep generosity in your life this week? That doesn't mean you have to put more in the collection plate, but how can you practice giving generously this week? Maybe you can do deep generosity through the practice of hospitality, inviting someone over for coffee just to get to know them, or spending time with somebody over breakfast just to talk about spiritual life, or inviting a family into your home just to get to know them better, or however it is that you practice hospitality. Or maybe your deep generosity takes the form of giving of your time and your energy. Maybe you go to visit one of our shut-ins or our members in the hospital. Maybe you go and clean someone's house that's having a difficult time just being able to get around and make ends meet. Maybe you spend just a few minutes stopping and listening to someone who needs it. Maybe you volunteer to teach a children's Bible class or mentor a child at Impact or give a mom a night off or invest in the lives of one of our students here at the church. Somehow it's giving of your time and energy. Or maybe that deep generosity is giving of your money. Maybe it's going and buying shoes for the homeless man who is looking for work on the street corner. Or maybe it's writing a donation to a charity that you love and respect. Or sending funds to a missionary in need just to take care of them. Maybe it's buying a box of books for a local underprivileged class in school. Or maybe it's buying a backpack and filling it up with school supplies for Operation Backpack. All of those things are just suggestions. They're not demands. Do whatever it is you feel called to do. But please remember that Jesus is calling us to a when you give, not an if. When you give, do so with a radical trust in God. Do so with a desire to please the Lord. And whatever you do, do it so that God gets all of the glory. And we serve a God who shows us that deep generosity, as He willingly gave up heaven to live among us, coming in flesh, becoming what we are so that we might become more like Him. And I'm amazed at the depths of the generous grace of God as He says, I freely give so that you might have life. That's the hope and the promise that God holds out to us. And if you don't know that hope and promise, we'd love to help you with that. If you need to learn more about Christ or you want to be baptized to give your life over to Him and His Lordship, or whether you just need us to stop and pray for you so that you might know a little bit more deeply the grace of God in your own life, or fill in the blank. We want to be able to do that for you. We're going to offer this public time of invitation, but there's also always a private invitation. Anything you need, you're welcome to call and talk to us at the office or to catch us in the hallways or anything else. If there's a way we can bless you this morning, come to the front as we stand and as we sing together.